From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. A new era in the Grand Ole Party has been ushered in. Michael Steele, the former lieutenant governor of Maryland, was chosen chairman of the Republican Party, the first African-American to hold that position. Speaking on News and Notes shortly after the presidential election in November, Steele talked about his reasons for seeking the GOP's top job.
I watched after the 2006 election, a party that was demoralized and really rudderless. And then we moved into 2008, and it got worse. You know, the party can't afford to step down and step back. It has to reengage. It has to reignite the ideas that were of importance to it during the last 15 or so years, and speak truth to power, speak honestly to the people, and let the folks stand clearly one way or the other, but let them have something to stand on. And so that's what pushed me to get back into this race.
Will the GOP change under his leadership, and how? Joining me to discuss this, we have one African-American Republican, George Davis, president of Davis Broadband, a management consultancy based in Los Angeles, and we hope to be joined shortly by another member of the Republican Party, Renee Amour, who is deputy chair of the Republican Party in Pennsylvania. So, George, welcome to News and Notes again.
Oh, thank you, Tony.
First off, are you excited about this?
I'm very excited. We heard the news, I think it was early this week, and there's probably about, I got like three or four emails from other African-American Republicans here in Los Angeles, so I think it's a, since there's only 10 of us, I guess a 30% response rate, so it was very, very positive.
You heard that Steele described the party as rudderless in that clip that we just played a few moments ago. How could he steer the party back on course from your point of view?
Well, I think there's, you know, kind of a traditional struggle going on right now between the social conservative and what my mother would call the Rockefeller Republicans is going on in the party. And Sarah Palin appealed to one group and kind of hurt us, who are probably more on the fiscal conservative and free enterprise and that side of the party. I think the bottom line is, because the Democrats have a similar struggle in trying to have the big tent, I think the bottom line is that the party can't continue to mainly be against something and really just appeal to one group of Americans, which honestly is perceived to be white male Americans, and kind of have everything against something, instead of saying, we care about people also. We just happen to have a different point of view how to approach it. And I think they haven't had an effective message on how to do that. And the demographics of the country have changed where they haven't been in step with those demographical changes.
Well, to speak to that, Steele said, in fact, that the message was what he was going to work on. George, we are joined now by Renee Amour, deputy chair of the Republican Party of Pennsylvania. Renee, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks for having me.
We asked George a moment ago, I don't know if you heard, whether or not he was excited about this selection of Michael Steele as GOP chair. Are you?
Yes, I am. Just so folks know that I did run for co-chair. But once Mike ran, I withdrew because I think it definitely, set a message that the folks really wanted him. I mean, it was six ballots, but I am excited, and we all just have to get behind Mike and beside him and work with him.
Now, George and I were just talking about what George thought were some of the major challenges that the party faced, and he suggested that the message was what needed massaging. What do you see as the major challenge?
You know what, George, I agree with you 100%, but I also look at, we have to have resources. We have to have resources out in the community, down to the grassroots folks, and in order to do that, Mike's going to have to raise a lot of money. The RNC is in a deficit, and we need money, to get those resources out to the different communities. We can't just be in Washington with a message.
Now, one of the things that he has been speaking about already, Steele, in terms of the message, is it has to do with immigration reform. He was interviewed on Fox Sunday about that, Fox News Sunday. And he's already indicated, George, in that interview that he does not intend to change the Republican position on immigration. So how can he expand the base without some movement there, particularly as it relates to trying to bring in Latinos and others?
Well, I think that is going to be real, having lived here in the southwestern part of the country and having talked to a lot of Latino business people who really, you would think by a lot of their values and how they look at things that they would be Republicans, but they have really been turned off by the party and talk radio, honestly, in terms of the tone of the message. I think there's a way of framing the message without having the hostility. I think that's one of the things that really backfires with our outreach to Latinos in particular.
Renee, would you say that in terms of Sarah Palin, let's mention her, because she represents a force in the party, does she not? And is that force not a polar opposite to what Michael Steele may have to, the direction Michael Steele may have to go in to expand the party?
You know what? She is a force to be reckoned with in the party. We have to work with Sarah Palin, and we have to bring everybody together. That's what's going to be difficult for Mike, Chairman Steele. He's going to have to pull all pieces together. You have moderate Republicans. You have the very conservative, the far to the right. What we're going to have to do is set a message and a tone, and George pretty much hit it. It's not what you say. It's how you say it so that we can pull everybody together, because that's the only way we're going to win these next elections, in particular in 2010.
Now, the question also is whether or not his presence alone, George and Renee, will change the perception of the party among African Americans, who in 2000 were beginning to inch over. You were one of them, George.
Yeah,
toward
yeah.
George Bush. I think they got 30%.
McCain. Yeah, but yeah, because George Bush did. He had a good record in Texas, particularly.
Yeah.
Right, but by 2008, that good will had eroded completely. Now, speaking on Fox News shortly after his win, Steele addressed that very issue.
Just because a black man is running the RNC doesn't mean black folks are going to go, oh, okay, now I'll be a Republican. Just as with the election of President Obama, all the problems and concerns that are very important to African Americans don't get solved overnight. There's still black businesses that are being redlined in neighborhoods that are struggling. So what I think it does do is send the appropriate message that right now at this hour, the Republican Party gets it.
Well, Renee, he's certainly right. Just because he's black doesn't mean blacks are going to flock to him. But the question that I have for you is, will the Republican Party expect him to deliver blacks because he's been elected to that position?
Absolutely. They really are. They really are. And so what's going to have to happen, you got to go out and talk to folks. Just because he's African-American and we're trying to pull minorities, not just African-Americans, into the party doesn't mean they are going to flock over. We have to go out with the right message and pull people back in the party. People really flipped because they didn't like our message, like you all just alluded to. And so we have to get back on track. In order to do that, first he has to get the message together. He has to get some resources. He has to get some field people out there to know what they're doing so that then they'll come, not just because Michael Steele is black, it has made a good statement, a different statement, but because they believe in the values that the Republican Party believe in.
What values would those be, George, that would be appealing to blacks in larger numbers than they've had so far?
You know, we're talking about the whole faith-based piece. I mean, George Bush started the whole faith-based initiative. Obama has said that he would, you know, continue that. You know, African Americans in particular believe into those things. Economic development, that's a very big deal for us, you know, to make sure that small businesses survive, you know, that we have a seat at the table. And those are just few of the things that, you know, that he has to start dealing with and getting his message together and out there.
I think that's what spoke to you, wasn't it, George, as a small black businessman?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just felt that the traditional black, if you want to call them black leaders or the Democratic Party, didn't speak to me. And I think the issue with a lot of African Americans with the Republican Party is they've made a lot of mistakes in terms of communicating, not knowing how to communicate to African Americans, and making honest mistakes in terms of policy. And so I think one of the things that was not mentioned, too, is sometimes in the past, the party just happened to have a black face and not a person that's credible in the black community. So I think that's also important with Michael Steele, where black folks cannot label him, you know, to be honest, Uncle Tom or something.
Right.
And
that
I think that's a real benefit of having someone like him who, quote, is considered, even, you know, agree with him, quote, he's a good brother. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important part of what bringing him along also.
How will the evangelicals in the party take to him, Renee?
You know, it depends on how Michael goes out and talks to them. He has to go out and pull people in. He basically did that in order to win this election also. I have to be honest, Michael Steele worked that floor. I was sitting there watching him, talking to people, saying what the bottom line is, he has to listen. He started listening to people, and that's what sold people on him. He listened. All that whole weekend he worked, and not even that, for the last 2 years, Michael has been going out trying to pull people in that particular sector also, and he'll continue to do that. He has to do it.
And the question that I have as we bring this to a close, George, is for you, and it's this. It would just seem to me that the job that Michael Steele has to try to put a new face on the Republican Party at a time that America is just really enthralled with Barack Obama as president, both Republicans and Democrats who are supporting him, that's a really uphill battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tony, I'm a student of history, and you know, if you look at history, things change over a period of time, and I'm sure President Obama will do a good job, but I think it's just like when Tom Bradley became mayor here and people were very excited. After a period of time, you have to govern. You have to deal with day-to-day issues. Mm-hmm. And so I think as time goes by and people settle into the adjustment of a black president, that the core issues will be such that people will be more open to looking at the full spectrum.
Well, we'll certainly have an opportunity to find out, won't we?
Absolutely.
Midterm elections are only 2 years away. That's mm-hmm. the first acid test for the new black chairman of the Republican Party. Thank you both very much for
coming on.
Thank you
for having me.
That was Renee Moore. She is deputy chair of the Republican Party of Pennsylvania. We also heard from George Davis. He is a management consultant based in Los Angeles and president of Davis Broadband Group, an international media and entertainment consultancy group. He joined me right here at the studios of NPR West. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Time now for our Africa update. This week, we're talking about leadership on the continent. Zimbabwean opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai agrees to become prime minister in a new Mugabe coalition government. Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi is chosen to lead the African Union. And a new Somali president is elected by parliament. For more now, we've got Roxanne Lawson. She is director of Africa policy for Trans Africa Forum. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. Zimbabwean opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has agreed to join the country's coalition government. The deal stated that President Mugabe would remain president while Tsvangirai would become prime minister. Mugabe, no secret, Tsvangirai's political nemesis. Will they be able to put their differences aside, which they haven't done so far, and tackle the serious problems in Zimbabwe?
Well, that's the real question. This week, actually next week, the 11th of February, we'll see the implementation of the Global Political Agreement, which was signed in September of last year. And due to the political differences between Robert Mugabe and his party, ZANU-PF, and Morgan Tsvangirai and his party, MDC, they've been unable to have a government. And so we've had a stalemate for several months. Now there seems to be some movement, but the next 8 days are critical. Although MDC, Morgan Tsvangirai, have agreed to come into the official government. He's agreed to become prime minister. It hinges on a number of political issues that have been being talked about and hashed out for the last 5 or 6 months.
It seems as if the SADC really had a hand in getting Tsvangirai to move to the position of agreeing to this. And I'm supposing that the international community's reaction, the anticipated reaction, may have also played a part. Am I right?
That's absolutely correct. The SADC, or the SADC, the Southern Africa Development Community, has been working since before the elections to try to quell the political divide between MDC and ZANU-PF. And under the leadership of former South African President Thabo Mbeki, have finally started to see some fruit of their labor. The UN has already spoken out. Ban Ki-moon has said that he will support moving forward, both politically and also economically, which is what Zimbabwe needs. They are in desperately need of an influx of international dollars to help stem both the economic and then the health crisis in Zimbabwe.
Talking about leaders, African Union leaders are meeting in Ethiopia's capital city to discuss the future of the coalition, and in a closed-door meeting, they chose Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi to head the 53-member union for a one-year term. This seems surprising to some, perhaps not to others.
From the African point of view, it's actually a really good move. I mean, first of all, the African Union rotates geographically, so it was time for a North African president. And Muammar Gaddafi, despite having a strained relationship with the United States, has long been a very active and vocal proponent of Pan-Africanism in the line of Nkrumah, and really trying to see a unified African body that can help solve Africa's problems from the inside out.
You know, Gaddafi wants the AU to function more like the European Union, where there is a central authority. But some of the other African countries fear, don't they, that that will erode their sovereignty. What are the pros and cons from modeling the AU after the EU, and how successful might Gaddafi be along that line?
Some of the pros are that there's already some of the infrastructure on the African continent for this. There are really strong and powerful regional blocs like SADC, as well as ECOWAS and the Ethiopian Development Community. And so all of those things can fit into this kind of EU model on the pro side. On the con side, the notion that African sovereignty will once again be kind of glossed over, if it were, by a larger force. I mean, under colonization, African leaders have, and African people have had a history of not being able to govern for themselves. And so there is some danger of that, although I do think that the Gaddafi way of looking at the African Union and its new way forward is one that's going to be hopeful. Already we've seen some immediate changes that seem to be strengthening the African Union's ability to be able to look at regional and African-wide problems, both economically and militarily.
Would you say that Gaddafi's association with terrorism, going back to the bombing of the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, Scotland, is that all water under the bridge? That's a terrible pun, and I apologize for that. But is that all past now in terms of his stature?
I think in politics, nothing is ever behind you. But I do think that for members of the African Union, for their leaders and for people on the ground on the continent, they also know that there's a larger story to Muammar Gaddafi, that he's done very much for his people, although he's been highly criticized by civil society in his own country, and that they see that African leadership takes on many different forms. And they're more concerned with the way in which African leaders interact with each other than the way they interact with outside leaders.
Last thing about Gaddafi, how long would you think it would take before we see a stamp, his stamp, on AU?
I think we're already seeing it. One of the outcomes of the meeting that Muammar Gaddafi actually asked, outside of him becoming president, was this transition from the AU commission to an AU authority. We're not exactly sure how that's going to play out, but it shows a shift in the way in which the AU is going to function as a much stronger bloc, not just with political will, but also with money and financing to do some of the things in the continent that need to be addressed.
Well, we've been talking about leadership so far. Let's continue that theme. Speaking of new leadership, Somalia has a new president, Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, the modernist Islamist leader elected by the country's parliament. What does this mean for the Somali people?
Well, hopefully it means an end to the devastating crisis in Somalia. The new president, Sheikh Shafar Ahmed, is the old president, in fact. He was actually president of Somalia under the Islamic Courts Union, which was ousted in the U.S.-backed Ethiopian invasion in 2006. And so we're seeing him come back to power, although he has distanced himself on some levels from some of the more extreme and Islamic forces within Somali civil society and government. He still is probably the only person that can unify that nation. He's calling now on the most extreme factions within Somalia to put down their arms, to stop their fighting with AU forces, which are in the country trying to stabilize it. And we've seen a kind of gradual turnover of power. The biggest issue, though, is whether or not the Somali government can actually function inside Somalia. These elections took place in Somalia's neighbor, Djibouti. If they cannot function inside the government, then it will be business as usual in Somalia.
Is there a question of whether or not, it sounds like it is based on your previous answer, whether he is connected more with the Arab world or with Africa?
There isn't really a question. I mean, Somalia sees itself as a bridgeway, and they're both a society of Bantu Somalis, which are more kind of ethnic African Somalis, and traditional Somalis, which are a blend of the Arab and African world. And so there isn't really that tension. I think mostly for Somalia, the biggest tension is whether or not the different political leadership can come together to actually secure the country so that regular Somalis can go about their lives.
Really briefly, my last question is this. Ethiopian troops were supposed to have pulled out of Somalia, but there are conflicting eyewitness reports that they have returned. What's the latest on that?
The latest on that is that the Ethiopian government has spoken out strongly saying that there are no troops within the government, that the only troops that people are seeing are these AU forces that are coming under attack from al-Shabaab, which is the kind of an armed activist group inside Somalia who's fighting for what they consider to be Somali self-determination. They're the ones who are mostly behind what may or may not be true, that Ethiopians are actually operating in the country, although all reports that we've had confirmed as of today have said that Ethiopian troops are behind the border of Ethiopia. And so we'll have to continue to monitor the situation.
So this doesn't mean that the new president is beginning with a crisis of that proportion, at least in the beginning.
He has enough crisis on his hands as it is. I mean, Somalia is far from a functioning country. Most of the people who live in Somalia are internally displaced. It's kind of some of the worst fighting and just the dire situation on the continent. I mean, we talk about all the time about different crises, but Somalia really is ground zero right now for crisis on the continent.
Roxanne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Roxanne Lawson is Director of Africa Policy for Trans-Africa Forum. She was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Like many developing countries, the images out of Ethiopia are often bleak. The images of poverty, war, and famine are all too familiar. But few people outside Africa are familiar with the sounds of Ethiopia. That is Mulatu Astatke. He is the godfather of Ethiopian jazz, and thanks to crate-digging DJs and the 2005 movie Broken Flowers, his music has now reached a global audience. Mulatu joined us recently to talk about his long legacy of music making. I started by asking him why Ethio jazz was becoming popular with international audiences today.
It's been taking, like, actually very long time for this music to be accepted, you know. So from places I play, places I perform, and, you know, things like that, and also doing recording, a lot of musicians seems to love it and seems to like it very much.
How would you describe it, that sound?
So how I described it is it's 5 tone against 12. This is how the Ethio jazz is, like the 5 tone being Ethiopian scales, and the 12th tone will be international, known, very famous progressions. So it's actually the connections of these two cultures, I should say, makes Ethio jazz.
It has, to me, from as a listener, kind of an eclectic sound, which means to me that it's you're drawing from different types of music, different cultural sounds. Is that correct or not?
The rhythms is very Ethiopian, and what we have actually combined is the harmonic structures, what we call the 12th musical structures, because our musical instruments hasn't reached to that stage. So I have actually to use pianos or guitars to actually combine it with the 5-tone scales.
Really? So you're saying that the instruments that are made or created in Ethiopia don't have the musical range for you to do the things that you want?
Yeah, what I'm trying to say actually is, see, our music usually is based on 5-tone scales, or what you call pentatonic. Our cultural musical instruments hasn't been developed.
Let's go back to the 1960s in Addis Ababa. Talk about the jazz music climate in your country at that time.
I started the development in America. I was at Berkeley in Boston. You know the situations, mostly in the third world countries, their attitude to music was actually very low. They have never taken music as a science or as a great subject like maths or physics or something. Whereas in a developed country, music has been taught in high schools, elementary schools, in kindergarten, as compulsory, like any other subjects, you know. So I've been one of the lucky African to attend high schools in England. Actually, that's where I found out my talent, because I got a chance. So at that time, we had teachers there, European teachers there. We'd actually teach the musicians to read and play charts from different bands here, from America actually, music charts and things like that. They could read very nice. But as far as improvisations, as far as the jazz feeling, actually, was not around. I remember always teachers telling us at Berkeley, said, we can only give you the tools. After that, it's you what to do with it.
Now, you were the first African student at Berkeley, correct?
Exactly.
What was it like for you to come from home to there, to be put in that musical surrounding, particularly given what you just described about the lack of really foundational support?
Actually, I went from England to America. So by the time I came to America, I think I was okay. I know exactly what was happening. And also, going to Berkeley, that was like +2 to what, you know, to what I wanted to do. So always telling us, we can give you only the tools and do. And then I came out, moved to New York. I created a music called the Ethio Jazz.
Now, let me ask you this. Talk about your interaction and your meeting and your involvement with the great Duke Ellington. How did that come about?
Well, that was great. Duke was one of the great musicians I've admired always in my life. Even I was studying in America at Berkeley, and we also used to study his compositions, his arrangements as well. And I always wanted to, you know, to meet a great man like him. So he came over to Ethiopia for the Jazz Ambassadors Tour. And that's where I met him. So, in fact, the American Embassy made me his escort, you know. I was supposed to be his escort by the American Embassy. So we're staying at the Hilton Hotel, and we've been discussing about music, and I took him around and showed him some of our very interesting musical instruments for him to evaluate and talk about. And finally, I had the opportunity to write music for his band and perform together at the Addis Ababa Hilton.
That should have been something.
I tell you, that was my really great dream, and it happened with Duke's band, you know.
Oh,
man. So it was a great privilege. I really thank him so much, and he played my music, and I remember, I'll never forget what he said. He said, "I've never expected this from African." That's what he said.
Interesting.
So it was very interesting.
Talk for a minute, if you can, about how your music has changed. You're the godfather, the founding father of Ethio Jazz in the 60s. Compare what that sound was then with what your sound is now.
It's about 45 years since I've done my recordings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My dream of Ethio Jazz in the future would be to upgrade Ethiopian musical instruments so they can be able to play 12-tone music. So to play Ethio Jazz with our cultural instruments, using all our traditional musical instruments, will be my dream.
Hip-hop artists have been sampling your songs, repurposed them into new compositions. How do you feel about that?
To tell you the truth, I don't feel very good about that, because my line is different than hip-hop. What I've dreamed to those music, to those melodies, to those rhythms, actually was different. It's what I call the Ethio Jazz. But what they did to those melodies and things and arrangements are a totally different approach to what our thinking about those melodies. But anyway, people seem to love it. And I'll just watch and see what the next movie is going to be.
You recently recorded an album with the UK band, the Heliocentrics. You don't want the hip-hop artists to sample your music, but you don't mind doing this. Why is that?
Well, I mean, Heliocentrics is not very hip-hop. So we try to come up with something different, what we've done. So it's like jazz fusions, all kind of things happening on this recording, you know.
I was caught by one of the songs because it had an Afro-Cuban sound to it, cha-cha. I would not have ordinarily thought of an Ethio Jazz expanding to Afro-Cuban sound.
Well, to tell you the truth, all this rhythm you mentioned, I belong to Africa. That's where the roots is and where it comes from. So, cha-cha-cha.
This is great. Thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you so much.
It's been our pleasure.
Great man. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
That was Mulatu Achdatki, godfather of Ethiopian jazz. He joined us here at the studios of NPR West. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. On January 20th, millions of Americans descended on Washington to watch the first African-American be sworn in as president of the United States. But few of those celebrating in Washington, D.C. may know the real story of how our nation's capital came to be. In Washington, the making of the American capital, Fergus Bordewitt examines the move from Philadelphia to D.C. and explores the political, racial, and cultural landscape that surrounded the construction of the nation's seat of government. Fergus, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Tony. Thanks.
I hope I didn't butcher your name too much. I apologize if I did. This book delves deeply into all of the political power struggles involved in the building of our nation's capital. Really briefly, first talk about how the capital was moved from Philadelphia to Washington.
Well, first, let's frame it a bit by way of saying that we got our capital on the Potomac River thanks to the politics of slavery and thanks to the hard physical labor of enslaved African Americans in the 1790s. There was a terrific political battle in the early 1790s over where the nation's capital was going to be. Think of the United States as just a collection of little mini states, mostly at odds with each other and without any great unifying national symbol. The capital was supposed to be that unifying symbol. Congress originally voted to place the capital in Pennsylvania, a free state in the North. However, as you can imagine, Southern slave owners were irate at the prospect of a free state capital that would set freedom as the national paradigm. They lobbied very aggressively for a Southern capital. There were 32 different sites originally considered, but the capital wound up on the Potomac thanks to probably the country's first real backroom deal cut between Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Alexander Hamilton.
Well, in fact, you talk a lot in the book about what you called corruption that surrounded the establishing of the capital where it was. And you mentioned, as you've just now done, that there were presidents involved, Jefferson, Washington, Madison, and Hamilton. So how much was the corruption part of this?
Well, George Washington himself was, as well as being our first president, simultaneously the president of something called the Potomac Company, which was a commercial enterprise dedicated to developing the Potomac River Valley as a great avenue, sort of the interstate highway of its day into the heart of the continent. Now, today, we would consider that a shocking and unethical conflict of interests. In those days, it wasn't. And Washington himself was given the job of selecting the actual location for the capital. He placed it just across the Potomac from his home at Mount Vernon, and his vice president, John Adams, later said rather grumpily that Washington increased the value of his own holdings by about 1,000%.
Interesting. You know, one of the things that we hear during Black History Month every year is about the contribution of Benjamin Banneker to the creation of the nation's capital. He, of course, was an African-American astronomer and surveyor. But in the book, you talk about another person from the British Virgin Islands by the name of William Thornton, who you said in the book really deserves a lot more of the credit than was given to him, and that Benjamin Banneker perhaps deserved a little less credit than what he's been getting.
That's not to say I want to diminish the role that Banneker played. Banneker was a remarkable man, one of the most interesting and original men of his time. And as you said, yes, he was a largely self-taught mathematician and astronomer. The role that he played in the laying out of the national capital, the District of Columbia, was as the senior assistant to the surveyor. And he performed an extremely important role by taking astronomical measurements that were essential to the surveying.
Now, that's the guy Ellicott, right?
That's right, Andrew Ellicott. Uh-huh. The fact that Banneker was there, a free African-American man, recognized in his own time, even by whites in the surrounding area, as a remarkable individual, is reason in and of itself to give him a great deal of credit. William Thornton, whom you mentioned, William Thornton was a white fellow who came from a Quaker background in the British Virgin Islands. He was sent to school in England, became radicalized as an abolitionist, and he came across the Atlantic to the new United States with a dream of emancipating enslaved people in North America and leading them to a new country in Africa. And ultimately, that country he had in mind became Liberia.
But what specifically did he do, as our time is running short?
William Thornton designed the United States Capitol building. He did many, many things, but that is the thing that perhaps he deserves to be most remembered for. And he was also an ardent opponent of slavery, the slavery that he saw all around him in the national capital. And I don't want to ignore the fact that hundreds of enslaved men, a couple of women probably as well, were the ones who actually built the Capitol building,
and
the White House.
Which is quite the irony on the day that Barack Obama was sworn in as president on the steps of a building that was built with slave labor.
Yeah, I think his history tells us that we all in this country, black and white, have been prisoners of slavery, and that its consequences remain right up to today, still embedded in our cultural DNA.
Well, let me stop you there only because our time has run out. It's a fascinating book, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your knowledge with our audience.
Thanks, Tony. And the book, again, if you don't mind my mentioning it, is Washington, The Making of the American Capital.
I was going to say it, but since you did, I guess I don't have to now. That was Fergus Bordewick. Thank you very much. He joined us from the studios of WGY in Albany, New York.
We've been running a series spotlighting some major figures of influence in American culture. We call the series Living Legends. Jazz giant Freddie Hubbard is on our list. Unfortunately, Hubbard passed away just last week before we could bring you the fascinating conversation that he recorded with Tony Cox. Tony's here to tell us a bit more. Hi, Tony.
Farai, you know, sensitive and precise, iconic and gregarious, competitive, out front and in your face. It sounds like I'm talking about an eccentric athlete, right? Well, in a way, it describes the great trumpet of Freddie Hubbard. Now, when I spoke with Hubbard late last year, he was 70 at the time and promoting his final CD, On the Real Side. You're hearing a track from it now. But for I, Hubbard seemed very unsettled by his inability to perform as he once did. So here's that conversation.
A lot of it, I don't have the chops. Because I used to play the head, and I used to play the solos and all the shouts and all that. But so one of the guys, David Weiss, he plays trumpet, he says, I'll arrange this stuff. You give me the songs, and I'll arrange it so you don't have to play all the way through.
How big a deal is this for you, Freddie Hubbard? Is this sort of a moment of, you know, am I able to do and be what I once was, or am I having to accept that time has put me in a different place? Are you sort of at that stage?
I'm at that because, see, you have to realize that one time or another in your career, when you get a little older, you can't do the things that you did before. Now, it's been very hard for me to accept that. I always felt like I could blow it and nothing ever happened until this happened. So now it's no matter how hard I practice, it just seems like I can't do things I did. But people tell me, say, man, you don't have to prove nothing. All you have to do is play good enough to get your point across, because I'm not gonna play like I did when you played those earlier records. And it's hard for me to accept that. You know, I don't want any of these young cats getting off on me, you know.
Let's go back to 1964. Mm-hmm. This is Breaking Point.
I was trying to play like a saxophone.
You did it.
Yeah, but I didn't realize the difficulty
of doing that.
Because you're not supposed to play the trumpet like that. By me getting with these saxophone players, I wanted to play like them, so.
You know, 1964, you were hot. You were on fire. What was it like at that time to be Freddie Hubbard, the star, the headliner?
You know, I was there and I was in competition. Competition with Lee Morgan, Bill Hardiman, Donald Byrd, all these guys were there, and it was a test. I mean, every time you played, you were being watched, and people compared you with Booker Little or Lee Morgan. So that competition kind of kept me going, you know. I mean, it made me strive to play better than I would normally.
What was the high point for you?
The high point, I would say, is when I was with CTI Records.
Cree Taylor.
And he had some ideas for me that really catapulted my career. And he got me a Grammy. I think I won a Grammy before Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie. 1972? Long time ago. Not that I thought I didn't deserve it, but not before a lot of the guys who hadn't received one who were great. But
and that was Red Clay, First Light.
Yeah, that was before I did that song, Creed said, man, right ahead. That's I said, oh, sure, here we go. Because commercialism never really fazed me. I mean, playing songs and licks that you knew everybody would like. I always wanted to be a true jazz artist, you know. Like Creed said, write a hit. So I wrote Red Clay. And all my friends who were jazz musicians, they said, man, you writing that square stuff. So it kind of, but that tune has earned me a living.
That's a great tune.
I mean, and it reminded me of my early childhood when I was back in Indianapolis.
They have Red Clay in Indiana?
No, because the guys used to sit on the porch and play their guitars and they would beat their tap their foot. So I kind of adopted that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. I mean, my people, my relatives, most of them are from Jackson, Mississippi. So when they migrated to Indianapolis, they kind of brought a lot of that feeling. When he said write a hit, that one song, man. People know me all over the world behind that. Russia, Africa, Japan, all over the world. But people, first thing they say when they see me, Red Clay.
In the course of your career, you've had obviously highs and you've had some lows, mm-hmm. and they've been described as personal problems without going into detail. Are we to assume that those problems were substance abuse related?
Well, substance abuse, I wouldn't really say I had a problem with that. I mean, I would say that at one period in the 70s, I started partying. I was in Hollywood Hills, and everybody would come up there. I mean, all kind of movie stars, all kind of football stars, basketball stars, actors. And I had a spot right there on Mulholland overlooking the Bowl, Hollywood Bowl. And the people that I had coming up there, now, the substance abuse, it was around, because a lot of people who would come to see me would bring it. But I would never really say I had a habit or anything like that. I had more of a drinking thing. I started drinking that Jack Daniels and Coca-Cola. And it tore my stomach up, so that was one period I wish I could forget. But, you know, when you're partying and you're young and you're making a little money and you're just having fun and you can overdo it.
You mentioned David Weiss. He was quoted as saying something, and I want to know if it really is true that he said it and how you feel about it. He called you, quote, the Barry Bonds of jazz. Did he do that?
I don't think. If he does, I'm going to smack him.
I was like, what? I'm not sure what he meant by
that. Did he say that?
Yeah, well, that's the quote. The context of it was that people were putting off on you or putting responsibility on you for things that other musicians were doing when it came to substance abuse or drugs or problems or whatever sort of thing is. He said everybody wants to sort of put this off on Freddie. He's the Barry Bonds of jazz.
Yeah, well, like a lot of people, I think, are kind of envious of me in that they can't play a lot of stuff that I play, but yet they don't want to admit it. Now, whatever reason that they dislike me, it has nothing to do with what I played. See? No matter what you say about Charlie Parker, he still created that. Now, maybe because of the substance abuse or whatever, because in the past, I used to wouldn't take any stuff from a lot of people. And I would open my mouth sometime and say some things to some people that I was believing it was right. But there's a certain way you have to do things and say things to people. for them to give you the respect. When it comes time for people, they may say some things about me that maybe I did do some of those things. So that determines their outlook on me.
When you have those moments when you are alone at home in your car, wherever, the backyard, and you sit back and you look back over your career, does a smile come to your face?
You know what? At one time they were talking about he's the greatest drummer player in the world. I mean, I don't believe that because no one person is the greatest drummer player. But when I think I can be put in the same sentence with Miles or Dizzy or Clifford Brown, anywhere in there, you realize how many trumpet players are in the world, and to be accepted all over the world as contributing something to this music that maybe nobody else could play or they like it, a smile comes to my face.
That was Tony Cox talking with the late, great Freddie Hubbard. Hubbard died last week.